for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The U.S. is weighing whether to support limited military action in Libya, but some say the best opportunities for intervention may have passed. Meanwhile, unrest and uncertainty grow in other parts of the Arab world. Joining me in the studio to talk about Libya and the region, Mark Quarterman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Mark Landler of the New York Times, pardon me, and David Schenker of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us by Twitter or on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Mark Landler, if I could start with you. Talk about Secretary Clinton's meeting in Paris.
Well, it's actually been sort of two separate meetings. One is a multilateral meeting with foreign ministers from the G8, which was sort of designed to try to marshal support around a response to Libya, perhaps a no-fly zone resolution that could be presented at the United Nations Security Council later this week. And then separately, but also importantly, Secretary Clinton met with a leader of the Libyan opposition in Paris late on Monday. This was important because the United States hadn't yet taken the step of meeting with a senior member of the opposition. There have been meetings between Libya's ambassador to the United States, who had defected from the government, but this represented a sort of a formal sign that the U.S. was prepared to deal with a government other than Muammar Gaddafi's. By all accounts, it was not a meeting that led to concrete steps or responses. It was held behind closed doors. Very few details were given out about it, so we don't really know what Secretary Clinton said to this gentleman. His name is Mahmoud Jibril. But the mere fact that she met him suggests a level of engagement on the part of the United States that is a step forward from where they've been so far.
There has been a request from France, from the EU, for a no-fly zone in Libya. What would that mean?
Well, you can look to precedent for what a no-fly zone means. And indeed, if you do look for precedent, there are some very clear cases. And it doesn't always mean the same thing. We had a no-fly zone over northern and southern Iraq for more than a decade. We also had a sort of a no-fly zone over Bosnia. And what it would mean depends a little bit on who you ask. If you ask the Secretary of Defense, Bob Gates, he describes a fairly aggressive military operation that would involve destroying Libya's air defenses to disable their ability to shoot down American or NATO planes that are over the country. And he describes that as a very large operation and one that, as a result, should only be entered into very carefully. There are those who argue you can do something that's a little less aggressive. But I have to say, in the United States, at least in the U.S. government, Secretary Gates's point of view has held a great deal of sway, and there's been a lot of reluctance on the part of the White House to even consider such a step. And perhaps the diplomacy of the last several days, including most importantly the endorsement of the Arab League for a no-fly zone, brings the U.S. a step closer. But there is still, as I say, some hesitance on the part of the U.S.
Mark Landler, he is diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. And joining us now from Cairo is Nancy Youssef. Good morning to you, Nancy.
Good morning, Diane.
Nancy is a reporter for McClatchy News. Nancy, I know you've been traveling throughout Libya over the past 2.5 weeks. What do the people of Libya say that they want?
Well, above all else, they want Muammar Gaddafi to no longer rule Tripoli, and that they want a new country with Tripoli still as its capital that no longer has any of his henchmen and his way of life and his green book over them. They are convinced that they can't do this on their own, and they want the West's help, and yet they don't want foreign intervention. That is, they want this to remain a Libyan effort. But having lost so many towns in such a short period of time, they can see that they need some help.
Well,
I'm
sorry, in your assessment, considering the fact that they have lost town after town, can they truly win the overthrow of Gaddafi without significant U.S. or other outside help?
Yeah, I don't think so, because they're just out. Their weapons aren't. You have to remember, these forces are filled with people who have never fighted. The rebel forces are filled with people who've never fired a weapon before. When I would go to the front lines, I was more afraid of them than I was of Gaddafi's forces. And Gaddafi's come up with a successful strategy, it seems. He comes in on these towns with airstrikes and missile strikes from ships at port, and the rebels flee, these poorly trained, ill-equipped rebels flee, and then his ground forces come in. He's done this in now three towns successfully. And so until that fear of the airstrike disappears, the rebels are simply outmanned. Now, they certainly have more will and more determination than Gaddafi's forces, but they simply don't have the weaponry to fend off airstrikes and missile strikes.
Nancy, you see, if McClatchy newspapers, she's just returned to Cairo after a 10-day reporting trip to Libya. Now, turning to you, David Schenker of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, some are saying that the optimal time for a no-fly zone has simply passed. What's your impression?
Well, certainly the rebels have lost a lot of ground in recent days and weeks. They've lost the one town that they had controlled west of Tripoli. They lost the third largest town, Misrata. Today they lost yet another town, and it looks like Gaddafi is marching on Benghazi, which is the largest city the opposition controls. Certainly it would have been better if we were going to do anything to have started already. I think many commentators think that we've been hand-wringing and dithering as the Libyans have been slaughtered, essentially, by Gaddafi. In spite of that, I think that if we take a step now and soon, we can maybe forestall the inevitable, or at least give the opposition, the rebels, a fighting chance.
David Schenker of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And turning to you, Mark Quarterman, you think the U.S. needs to proceed with great caution.
I do think the U.S. needs to proceed with great caution. I think also that the U.S. needs to let the multilateral process play out. Secretary Gates was very clear that unilateral U.S. action would not be advisable. Having said that, though, I believe very strongly, as do a number of people, that that these multilateral processes, the Security Council, are not set up to take rapid action in the case of extreme violence. As much as we say never again after Rwanda, of course, first after the Holocaust, but after Rwanda, after Srebrenica, the member states, the leading member states, have not set up mechanisms to ensure that there can be rapid action in violence. Multilateral processes are slow. It requires agreement between a number of different states, including states that have very sharp differences over intervention in the domestic affairs of other states. And we're seeing that now in the discussion in the Security Council over a follow-on resolution on Libya.
You know, it's interesting, Mark Landler, that the Arab League is really pushing for some action, but the Arab League itself is not going to participate.
Well, yeah, the Arab League, in effect, is giving a stamp of approval for other people to take the lead in this, which is partly a simple matter of capability. I mean, most people acknowledge the Europeans can obviously supply planes to an effort like this, but the United States, by general acknowledgement, would have to play a central role in terms of providing the military capability. So that's why, to some extent, this conversation depends on the United States weighing in at some point for it really to gain traction and momentum. And I come back to what I said earlier. I think there is a great deal of reluctance on the part of the administration. I think a telling moment in all this came late last week when the National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, held an hour-long conference call with reporters, largely devoted to Libya, but also talking about some of the other crises in the region. The point he made at the very end of that call, the most important thing he said was right before he signed off. And he said, we are, of course, concerned with the crisis. I'm paraphrasing. We are, of course, concerned with the crisis of the day, but we have to keep our eye on the broader challenges. If you speak to administration officials, they will tell you they still think this ballgame is largely about Egypt and what happens in Egypt. To some extent, it's, of course, also about the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain. But from an American national security standpoint, Egypt and the Gulf are far more important than Libya, a country from which we don't buy much oil, with which we've only had diplomatic relations for a few years. And that's not to say the U.S. could somehow stand by if there was a genuine genocide underway, but it does suggest that they don't view in the administration Libya as a vital national security interest of the U.S.
Mark Lantler, he's diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. We'll take a short break now. When we come back, we have someone on the line from Benghazi, and we'll take your call. Stay with us. Welcome back as we talk about the ongoing strife in Libya. And joining us now from Benghazi is Mufta Tahuni. He's a supporter of the opposition. For safety reasons, he asked that his tribal name be used instead of his real surname. Good morning to you, Mufta. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Diane.
Please tell me where Gaddafi's forces are. Are they now close to taking control of Benghazi?
No, not close, but they are bombarding the next biggest town to Benghazi, which is Kolej Dabia. It's about 150 kilometers west of Benghazi. The man has a huge power, firepower, all kind of weapons, and he's the opposition consists mainly of civilians with the small weapons. So it's not a fight between two armies. It's a fight between thugs and brigades of Gaddafi's brigades, mercenaries who are have all kind of weapons, sophisticated weapons, air force strikes, ship strikes, hitting civilian areas, and inflicting heavy casualties on civilians. That's what's going on right now. It's a real massacre.
Tell me who is in charge of the opposition.
Now the in charge of opposition is the Council of a Military Man, even though Gaddafi made sure in the past to destroy the army as an institution, and it made real power in his brigades, which led by his sons and his cousins. And, you know, dictatorship usually relies on family members to run the military brigades. And so the opposition is run by former army officers and civilians, basically, who have no knowledge of weapons except small ones, and they just start learning them how to use those weapons.
And tell me what you think a no-fly zone would accomplish.
A no-fly zone will be a helpful for the opposition, that at least will eliminate one source of threat, which is early bombardment to the where the opposition is before his ground troops start moving. If we have the no-fly zone, will eliminate that danger, and it would be now we will have the upper hand if he comes into our cities to fight him in the street cities, a street fight, you know, which is he is not prepared for it, because Gaddafi's thugs are, you know, fighting for money, but they are not fighting for beliefs, and we are fighting because we believe we are right. We believe we need to be free after 42 years of iron fist rule by a madman. He's a delusional man. He's a man who controlled this country with no repercussion, without you know, fear of any reprisal. He has the money. He has the total wealth of the country to squander on a mercenary or on buying weapon for his his brigades.
Mark Lattenler of the New York Times has a question.
Muftai, I just wonder, the United States and President Obama from the start has been reluctant to intervene not only in Libya but anywhere in the Middle East, because they're worried that the moment they intervene and start, as they put it, dictating outcomes, that it's sort of no longer a homegrown movement. It strikes me that we're past the point of having that debate in Libya. Based on what you say, it sounds like you feel like you're being forsaken by the West. I mean, does President Obama have a point when he worries about the West intervening, appearing to be yet another colonial power going into the Middle East, or have we moved past that point?
Ground troops to intervene. We don't want Americans to fight our fights. We only want no-fly zones to help us fight Gaddafi. For the point that Gaddafi at Obama feels that if he intervenes, it might be perceived as a colonial. No, I don't think so. I don't. What's going on? Because what's going on in Libya is like what's going on in Rwanda. It's like what's going on in Serbia and Srebrenica. It's a massacre. It's a man who has all the power, all the money to buy the mercenaries, fighting his own people, massacring his own people. And people in the history will start talking about it as like you talk about Rwanda, and like we should intervene, we should help those people. The movement starts with a civilian, a peaceful movement started by young people walking the streets without no weapons, a civilian movement, people who are facing bullets with bare chests, you know.
Right.
And it still is. We only forced to bear arms just to defend ourselves. And the arm we took from Gaddafi's thugs. We have no source of armament, you know.
All right, Muftai Tarahuni, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Diane.
All right, and turning to you, and now, is Nancy Youssef still with us? Okay. Nancy, you heard him. You heard Mufta Tarhuni. Is that is what he said consistent with what you saw, what you are hearing? He talks about a wholesale slaughter.
Well, yes. I mean, in the towns that he's going into, there are numerous area bombardments. A lot of them, though, are missing people. I was near one where it would have been very easy to kill several hundred people, and they're missing us. I think, in a way, these bombardments are designed more to scare people away. That said, in Benghazi, where Mustah lives, there is a sort of subversive campaign going on where people are being threatened by Gaddafi forces still in town. They're being told that if they take sides with the rebels, they will eventually be killed. And many rebels will tell you that if we don't win, then we're going to be killed or hung in the public square by Gaddafi if he's able to. And that is either way, they feel like they face death. So their only option is to fight and to hold on to the territory that they have.
David Schenker, what about the idea of arming the rebels?
Well, I think this gets into a whole can of worms that goes beyond no-fly zone. We know that these people are fighting bravely and that they are committed to their cause, but we don't know exactly who they are. We don't want a situation where we put weapons that are larger than RPGs or anti-tank weapons in the hands of people who, essentially may not be our friends indefinitely. So you look at what happened with Afghanistan, for example. There is, and by all counts, it doesn't appear that these people are running this opposition, but there is a presence of al-Qaeda in Libya. There's a Libyan Islamic fighting group that allied with al-Qaeda some 10 years ago. The Libya served as a second leading point of insurgents who entered Iraq to kill Americans behind Saudi Arabia. So, we don't know who everybody is there. And while it may help in the short term, I'm not sure it's in our long-term interest to do that.
Mark Quarterman, what happens if Gaddafi wins?
Well, I along with a number of people, am seeing with sadness the violence there, and clearly the Gaddafi regime is an autocratic regime that could well be carrying out crimes against humanity in its bombing of civilians, and which is one of the reasons why the Security Council referred the issue to the International Criminal Court. But I think that your broader question, Diane, is are we looking at a civil war, or are we looking at a situation like Rwanda, where there was a genocide? And I worry that our reactions are more geared to the history of inaction in Rwanda rather than a desire for efficacious steps that will actually bring about effective goals in Libya. And I wonder, for example, precisely what a no-fly zone would accomplish. Would it turn the tide? Would it create enough of a stalemate for a negotiated settlement? Will it lead to Muammar Gaddafi's removal from office? We're not entirely sure, in part because we do have so little knowledge about the situation in Libya. I'm also afraid that it might lead to a slippery slope, too. If we decide to back one side in this civil war and the no-fly zone doesn't really turn the tide or doesn't help them, where do we go from there?
David Schenker.
Yeah, no doubt there's a concern, I think, about mission creep, but I think there's some very real implications for the United States if Gaddafi wins. Certainly, on the ground in Libya, there will be gulags. People will be executed by the hundreds, if not thousands. I think that's for sure.
Many are already being taken away and tortured.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think in the broader sense, there's this implication about the United States' presence in the region. Our ally Mubarak falls, our ally Ben Ali falls in Tunisia, and now Gaddafi gets to stay. It's going to undermine confidence in the United States and the region. Our allies in the Gulf in particular are going to look at this and say that that we're not involved anymore, that we have no interest, we're getting out of the region. They may look to cut a deal on Iran because we're not going to be there to protect them from this predatory state. It's going to fuel conspiracy theories about U.S. keeping Gaddafi in power. And it's going to ensure, I think, essentially, that all future revolutions in the Middle East or elsewhere are met with overwhelming force, that the way to approach this is to slaughter people and you can just get away with it.
Mark Landler.
I was simply going to second David's last point that a lot of what's happened in the Middle East in the last 2 months, one country has acted as an example or an inspiration for another. So if Gaddafi survives by crushing this brutally, it's a template or a precedent for anyone else who's in that situation. And you know, it's not as though there aren't already precedents for this. The Iranians did it a couple of years ago. The Chinese did it after Tiananmen Square. But to the extent that you began to see ferment in a lot of other places, including in China in the last few weeks, a bad outcome in Libya gives other autocratic leaders the pretext they need to crush any rebellion and not try to come to the kind of accommodations that the U.S. so desperately hopes for in places like Bahrain, for example, where we have thrown our weight behind a reform process and a royal family that seems to be teetering between whether they want to really engage or simply rely on reinforcements from the Saudis to crush the opposition.
Mark Landler, he is diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Mark Quarterman, you wanted to add something.
Well, thanks, Diane. I actually agree with what Mark and David are saying up to a point, and what we're in that there could be a demonstration effect. We're seeing even far afield from Libya in Cote d'Ivoire and the attempt of an autocrat to stay in power and using violence against his people. I suppose the question I have, though, is When I hear the arguments about the demonstration effect, then I hear, well, we have to make sure that that demonstration effect doesn't occur. And so what steps do we take to make sure that it wouldn't occur? And I'm not so sure that the U.S. has the power to affect outcomes in the Middle East in the way that implies. So we have to think about what these steps will accomplish, whether an ineffectual no-fly zone might also be a negative step as well, that the international community was willing to go a little bit down the line to support this uprising, but not far enough.
Not far enough, meaning?
Meaning Gaddafi still might win. There still might be the demonstration effect for other autocrats. So once again, if we think about actions we need to take, we should think about what we want to accomplish and what they can realistically achieve.
What do you think could be worst-case scenario, Mark Landler, if Gaddafi stands firm for the other areas of the world, like Bahrain, like Saudi Arabia?
Well, again, not to over draw the demonstration effect argument, because some of these things are happening on their own momentum. But I think we're already seeing a very troubling development in Bahrain, where you have not only the Saudis, but other Gulf neighbors sending in troops and reinforcements at the request of the Bahrainis, they say. But let's face it, Bahrain is a vassal of this of Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis are simply not going to allow a Shiite-led insurrection in that country because of their fears about their own country. So I think that Gaddafi surviving, you know, does have some spillover effect in the region in terms of setting a bad example. But some of these things are going to happen for their own reasons. And I think what's happening in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia is much more linked to a long-running tension between Shiites and Sunnis, a sense of insecurity on the part of Sunni leaders, a sense of resentment and anger on the part of Shiites. And that's, to me, a very troubling new development that, frankly, the U.S. is even less well-positioned in some ways to respond to because of our deep strategic reliance on Saudi Arabia.
But should the rebels somehow regain a foothold in Libya, should Muammar Gaddafi be ousted, would that give new energy to those who want to overthrow the monarchy, establish a parliamentary government in Bahrain.
So there are people who are calling for constitutional monarchy. Bahrain is different than Libya, though. I think the level of repression is less, and the monarchy was willing and has been willing, I think, you know, like we heard from Mark, willing to negotiate and talk about political reforms. I think they are teetering, bolstered by the Saudis to crush this and put an end to it. But we also have to remember that this is a state. You know, at one point, the Sunni and the Shiite were cooperating, talking about reforms with the monarchy in Bahrain. But recently, the Sunnis are getting very scared about the prospects for Iranian influence in Bahrain. I mean, this is not only about Sunni Shiite. This is about Iran, which has a historically staked a territorial claim on Bahrain. So the Saudis are concerned about this. They have their own Shiite population. And not all Shiites, even in Bahrain, want this type of Iranian influence. It's a very complex thing. But the point is, these are different states, and there are different chances for reform in both. Gaddafi will not ever be a reformer.
David Schenker, Mark Landler, Mark Quarterman. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, time for your calls and email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. By the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Writer Joshua Foer began his new book as a slightly forgetful journalist. By the end, he had become a national memory champ. Along the way, he learned how memory works and the art of remembering everything. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're back talking about the current situation in Libya. It's time to open the phones. We'll go first to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Good morning, Mohammed. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning to you, Diane. I like to say that what is happening in Libya is an armed rebellion against the government. It is not anything more than that. Those people are nothing but rebels who are against the government. So I think Gaddafi has the right to use power against them.
That's interesting. How do you react, David Schenker?
Well, this is obviously a person who either is a monarchist, a loyalist to authoritarian regimes. I think fundamentally, this is not in any sense a government that would have legitimacy by anybody's imagination. It has been committing atrocities of the worst kind for 42 years, you know, killing its own people, killing foreign nationals, you know, the Label Disco, the UTA French airliner downed in Africa, the Pan Am Lockerbie. The atrocities go on and on, perpetrated against the people of Libya. This is a guy who took over in a coup in 1969, and the areas that he's looking to crush now never particularly liked him. They liked the king.
Here is an email representing a point of view that many of you have. It's from Kevin in Albuquerque, who said we should help the Libyans before it's too late. The world is watching, as for a billion Muslims. Mark Quarterman.
No, I sympathize with that, and I'm actually not opposed to intervention. I think it should be carried out under international law and with the support of the Security Council, which would also provide legitimacy for it. I suppose I'm only saying that we need to be clear about what we're trying to accomplish, and we might not help the people we want to help with actions that aren't designed to do that.
Let me read to you an AP bulletin. Bahrain's king has declared a 3-month state of emergency, gave the country's military chief wide authority to battle a Shiite-led protest that's threatened the Sunni monarchy and drawn in forces from around the Gulf. The martial law style order was read out on Bahrain state television a day after more than 1,000 Saudi-led troops arrived to help prop up the U.S.-backed regime in the first major cross-border military action to challenge one of the revolts sweeping across the Arab world. Mark.
Now, it just strikes me that this illustrates the complexity of this issue for the U.S. government. The Gulf Cooperation Council, which is made up of the countries in the Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, has condemned Libya and called, I believe, for the removal of Muammar Gaddafi. That same group now, not as the group, but the members of that group have sent troops into Bahrain to put down the rebellion there. This is extraordinarily complex, and it makes it difficult then to make a blanket policy that we will apply country by country.
Dave Chanker.
Yeah, the same inconsistency applies to the Arab League. I mean, the Arab League now is calling for a no-fly zone in Libya. They're calling for U.S. involvement. This is and condemning Gaddafi. This is the same group, the Arab League, that was opposed to no-fly zone in Darfur, and that in 2009 the Arab League hosted Omar Bashir, the indicted war criminal president of Sudan, for killing a million people in Darfur. They hosted him at the Arab Summit in Doha, Qatar.
Mark Landler.
Well, and the same inconsistencies from country to country are what is making the U.S. response such a difficult one. And, you know, one thing that President Obama and his advisors have been very clear on is that we are going to approach this on a country-by-country basis. They talk about pushing for general principles of respect for universal rights and peaceful protests, but they're underlying that is a sense that many of these things will play out very differently, and the U.S. needs to be agile and different as different things pop up.
All right, let's go to Henry in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. I have several things, Diane. I'm surprised that experts over there don't consider if we start to bomb with the overflight of how many civilians would be dying, just like we overtook Iraq. And from what I keep hearing, 1 million people have died since we've been in Iraq. And the other thing would be is the men been in there for 40 years. Don't remember anybody taking a shot at him or tried to kill him. So it's kind of conflicting. And then that number four would be, don't you remember our own riots? What did we do with the people?
Mark Landler.
Well, he raises a good point about no one ever having taken a shot at Gaddafi. I mean, that's not
quite true. He's pretty well protected, isn't he?
And it isn't quite true. The U.S. has had strikes against Libya years and years ago. But it is true that when you have this discussion of a no-fly zone, a legitimate argument is, well, we have tolerated this guy for decades. So, you know, why should we now suddenly intervene in a situation we didn't intervene in before?
But what about the deaths that Henry talks about, civilian deaths that could result from instituting that kind of no-fly zone? Wouldn't there necessarily be civilian casualties?
I think there would necessarily be casualties, and I'm not a military expert, but I imagine that a well-designed no-fly zone where you're targeting air defenses and maybe cratering runways, sure, there could be the potential for collateral damage and casualties.
I hate that phrase.
It's a terrible phrase.
It
sort of leaches all the humanity out of it.
Exactly.
Okay, killings of civilians. And that's probably unavoidable. One would hope that if it were well designed and well executed, you'd keep those numbers down. And I guess the argument would be, in any event, if you're preventing a wholesale slaughter by Gaddafi, isn't it worth taking that risk?
All right. To Tulsa, Oklahoma. Good morning, Shannon.
Yes. Iraq and Afghanistan did not ask for our help, but were there anyway. The people of Libya have asked for our help, and yet we continue to ignore them. This is America. It's supposed to be the home of the brave, and yet our politicians are too chicken to do the right thing.
David Schenker.
Yep, Secretary of State Clinton said it on February 25th. This is a time for action. Now is the opportunity for us to support all who are willing to stand up on behalf of the rights we claim to cherish. Well, it's much past the 25th. I think we do have a responsibility. I think they want us there. I think the Arabs have.
So you think we should go to establish a no-fly zone?
Yeah, I do. I think
you do.
I think it's a little bit late, but I think we should.
Mark Quarterman.
I think that David is right that Secretary Clinton did say that. The problem is, what do you do about it? And where do you stop? We're also being asked for help by the opposition in Cote d'Ivoire. There are any number of other places where the U.S. might intervene. We're actually in a period of relative U.S. decline, where other countries are rising, and the U.S. is, I would think, less able to send its military and act willy-nilly around the world. I mean, certainly what's happening in Libya is horrible, and it could rise to the level of crimes against humanity. But I wouldn't say that our leaders are too chicken. I think that what's going on is they're being very careful and cautious about taking actions that are effective and that we're capable of.
Nancy Youssef, do you want to step in?
I did, only because, I wanted to tell you, that's the feeling among Libyans, too. Why isn't the United States getting involved? I was outside of Ajdabiya about 3 days ago, and I ran into a history teacher who rattled off Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and all these American names, and he said, your country stands for freedom, and here we are fighting for our freedom. Why won't you help us? That's how Libyans feel. I heard it over and over and over again. They don't. The discussion we're having in terms of the consequence of it, if you're on the front line, you're not thinking about that. You want some form of help, or at least some acknowledgement that you're doing something for your country. And I think for Libyans, just having their opposition council formally acknowledged by the United States would mean something. But the silence from the United States is deafening on the front line.
David Schenker, what is the likelihood that the U.S. could enforce a no-fly zone? What's the likelihood that Libyan forces would fire on planes trying to maintain that no-fly zone or on a U.S. humanitarian aid ship?
Listen, there are many risks to doing this type of operation. I don't want to downplay that. But there are military people who are experts in these issues who say that these are overcomable. You take care of the air defense systems. As the former chief of the staff of the Air Force, General Merrill McPeak, said recently. He said, I can't imagine an easier military problem if we can't impose a no-fly zone over a not even third-rate military power like Libya, then we ought to take a hell of a lot of our military budget and spend it on something usable. You know, there are people out there who think that we can do this with minimal risk to U.S. forces. And particularly if we have international buy-in on this, I think it's something we really have to consider.
All right, to Mystic, Connecticut. Good morning, Austin.
Good morning, and hi to everybody. I just wanted to respond to those who are supporting the no-fly zone and those commentators on the various talk shows and the last caller who seemed to want to paint this administration and President Obama as being weak as a leader or chicken, and say that Afghanistan was a different case because we were retaliating for an act of war against us. I don't think anybody would agree that we want to use Iraq as a template for how we should act in the future with some of these dictators across the Middle East. And with Libya and now Bahrain and maybe Jordan and all these places, at what point do we stop feeling as though we have to police a region that we have very tenuous ties with and very, you know, complicated ties with? And if we keep doing that Iraq thing, trying to take over these countries that we feel is weak enough that we can take over, where is that going to leave us in blood and treasure? We're already in a very bad situation with our deficits right now, and I don't see us running into Iran when they have humanitarian issues or China when they had humanitarian issues. So is it that we only bully those countries we think we can win against?
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Mark Quarterman.
Well, at the risk of seeming contrary now, I think that diplomacy is about, as people say about politics, diplomacy is the art of the possible. We might condemn the Iranian government for its actions against its civilians, but we know that no amount of military action we might take or an extreme amount of military action might turn the situation around. If we decide that a reasonable amount of military force can turn the tide and can make the difference, I think we should do it. So it's not about making blanket policies either to intervene or not to intervene, but to think about each particular case. And in the case of Libya, it could well be.
But as you said, Mark Lantler, Secretary Gates' position is really holding sway right now, is it not?
I feel that very much it is, and I think it's a combination of a very deeply felt belief on the part of President Obama that intervening, that thrusting the U.S. into the Middle East can only provoke a backlash, that one of the great virtues of Egypt and Tunisia were that they were homegrown. And I do think they genuinely worry about that, plus the fact that between all the other challenges on the plate today, and we haven't even talked about Japan, there are so many reasons that the U.S. is going to have other obligations that will make it difficult.
Let me ask you all something. Could what's happening in Libya now affect ongoing progress in Egypt and Tunisia? Mark Quarterman.
I think it was David Shinker who said that there really could be knock-on effects and that autocrats might see what's happening in Libya and realize maybe I don't need to retire to Sharm el-Sheikh. Maybe I can stay in power and use my military. But once again, it's a country-by-country question. The military in Egypt made it very clear that they weren't going to fire on their civilians. The military in Libya is organized in a completely different way from the military in Egypt, from the military in Bahrain, from the military in Yemen. So I think that we're going to see, we'll probably see demonstration effects, but will we necessarily see templates? I don't think so.
Mark Lantler.
Well, I'd only say that the country we haven't talked about for the last 45 minutes is Yemen, where there's also been extremely negative developments, including the stabbing of this provincial governor. And the violence that broke out in Yemen broke out about an hour after the White House's counterterrorism coordinator, John Brennan, spoke with the Yemeni president, Abdullah Saleh, and urged him not to use violence against the protesters. So to speak to the point of how relatively little influence we may have. Remember, Robert Gates was in Bahrain the day before the Saudis came in, and an hour before the security forces opened fire in Sana'a, that we were urging Saleh not to do it. So I think we need to understand that our influence is limited in many of these cases.
David Shanker.
No, I think Yemen is an entirely different story. It's essentially a failed state, you know, with a dictator who controls about the amount of territory that is paved roads. You know, the amount of influence that we have is basically the amount of influence that one might have in Sana'a. But certainly Bahrain, it's a different calculation. And Saudi, at the end of the day, is a very different calculation about what the cost of instability in a place like Saudi Arabia would be. We know that the market is going down dramatically today. If there was instability in Saudi Arabia, there would be a global financial catastrophe.
David Shanker of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, Mark Landler of the New York Times, Mark Quarterman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The turmoil continues. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.